Life in Siberia and Death. After a grueling 2-week train trip, the exiles, along with their meager belongings, were finally let out of the boxcars into the cold snow. At the nearby collective farm, foremen came to select the best workers for their farm, much like landowners buying workers at a slave market. Many of those who lived in Siberia were exiles themselves, and they felt compassion for the newcomers. Thus, with the help of fellow believers and friendly locals, the exiled brothers soon got settled. Some were able to establish a relatively normal life. A few even experienced unexpected health benefits, such as the two Estonian sisters who had tuberculosis but recovered when they moved to the drier Siberian climate. But not everyone was so fortunate. At least one child died on the train, and one elderly witness died as a result of the difficult conditions or emotional trauma. Some brothers became disabled because of lack of proper medications or because of the overly demanding work. Others were affected by the harsh living conditions, poor nutrition, sickness, accidents, and extreme cold. In addition, many endured the emotional pain of being torn away from their families for many years and never receiving the letters written by their loved ones. "Since our family consisted only of children and very young women," explains Tina Cruz, "we were taken to a rather poor collective farm. The members of the commune didn't have sufficient food even for themselves, not to mention us. Newcomers chewed on pine bark and edible roots, and often had nettle soup. The winters in Siberia are long and bitterly cold, a severe climate to which the Estonian exiles were not accustomed. Even the most normal activity, such as growing potatoes, was seldom successful. For most, the first year in exile was grueling and was accompanied by persistent pangs of hunger. It was minus 60 degrees Fahrenheit," recalls Hisi Lember. "Because of the cold, we kept the hen's cage under our bed to prevent the hen from freezing to death. Some even had a calf with them in their house if it happened to be born in the winter." Off to new territory, at the state's expense. Years earlier, William Day had said that if the Soviet Union ever took over the Baltic countries, the brothers would have vast new territories in which to preach. How true those words proved to be. The Soviet government really helped Jehovah's Witnesses extend their preaching work to Siberia and other faraway places by sending them into exile. Although Jehovah allowed his witnesses to be tested, many who had never even heard the divine name thus had the opportunity to learn the truth. Lembit Trell, for example, had been arrested for anti-government activities. He heard about the truth in 1948 in an unusual way, in a prison cell in Tartu. A Russian army officer, who was also being detained, told him about the witnesses he had met in another prison cell. The officer gave Lembit a short summary of their teachings. He explained that God's government is the only solution and that God will soon start to rule over the earth. That aroused Lembit's interest. Lembit was eventually sent to a prison camp in Varkuta, in the far north of Siberia, close to the Arctic Ocean. There he overheard a group of witnesses talking about the Bible. When he got closer, he discerned that they were discussing the same things he had heard about from the officer, so he joined their conversation. "Why are you in prison?" the brothers asked Lembit. "I was fighting for justice," he replied. "Did you succeed?" one of the witnesses inquired. The answer was obvious, but Lembit replied, "No, I did not." "Look, you fought on the wrong side," a brother pointed out to Lembit. "Wouldn't you rather fight on the right side?" Then they started explaining what the Bible says about spiritual warfare. The more he heard, the more Lembit realized that he had found the truth, and the more he saw the need to join Jehovah's side of the spiritual warfare. After his release, Lembit returned to Estonia and started his spiritual warfare. He now serves as a regular pioneer. His wife, Maimu, found the truth in a similar way. Her interest was kindled in prison by a non-witness. The following is from page 199 of the printed edition. It's your mother. Karine Riley, born 1950, baptized 1965. Profile: born in prison and taken from her mother to be raised by her grandmother.
I was born when my mother, Maimu, was in prison because of her political activity. I was a weak baby, and on account of the coldness of the prison cell, I contracted double pneumonia. But I survived, thanks to another prisoner, Laine Prum, who later learned the truth. At that time, many of the prisoners' babies were sent to orphanages throughout the Soviet Union so that they would forget their parents. Fortunately, I was given to my grandmother. My mother was sent to a prison camp in Mordvinia, where she met Ella Tome, a courageous sister. Mother accepted the truth and was baptized there. For the next 5 years, my grandma raised me. Unexpectedly, one day a strange lady appeared at our house. "It's your mother," Grandma said. It was a very confusing experience, and it took me several years to get over it.
Happily, Karine and her grandmother also accepted the truth. Later, Karine learned English and began helping with the translation of our publications. She married Lembit Riley, and they now serve together in the Estonia branch. Returning to the account, the preaching work was difficult for the brothers who did not speak much Russian. But even with their limited vocabulary, it was always easy for them to start a conversation by talking about the reason for their exile in Siberia. This approach helped the brothers to master informal witnessing. Furthermore, they had ample opportunity to witness to Estonian exiles in their mother tongue. One survivor estimates that between 15 and 20 Estonians learned the truth in the camps, as did a number of Russians and Lithuanians. How to get spiritual food. Many methods were used to smuggle Bibles and spiritual food into prisons and to exiled witnesses living in isolated areas. We received pages of literature in jars of pork or other animal fat, explains one brother. Because the fat turned white in the cold, the paper could not easily be seen. Although the officials inserted a knife into the jars, they hardly ever detected the thin paper, which was pressed close to the sides of the jar. The officials seldom found the precious spiritual food hidden in the jars of literal food. Little pieces of literature could also be sewn into a handbag or clothing, hidden in a soapbox, or pressed into a hollowed-out bar of soap. "I could fit 4 watchtowers into the soap in a soapbox," says Ella Tome. The following is from page 202 of the printed edition. Handmade Books. Helmi Lek, born 1908, baptized 1945, died 1998. Profile: imprisoned and sent to Siberia. Helmi was arrested as one of Jehovah's Witnesses and sent to Siberia, where she made a small purse for her notebook. She stitched a comforting scripture on it, Romans 8:35. Who will separate us from the love of the Christ? Will tribulation, or distress, or persecution, or hunger, or nakedness, or danger, or sword? Helmi found some pieces of brown paper and used them to make a book. In it were some encouraging biblical thoughts. Many brothers copied entire books by hand, as there were not many printed publications available. After returning from Siberia, Helmi told the officials, "I am thankful to you that you sent me to see the beautiful mountains of Siberia. I would never have had money to travel that far." Returning to the account, although letters were censored, the witnesses learned how to camouflage Bible truths and theocratic language with everyday words. For example, one sister wrote, "We are richly taken care of by the Father, also having a rope that reaches the well." She indicated that the Father, Jehovah, was providing for them spiritually, that they had contact with the Well, Jehovah's organization, and that they had access to life-giving waters of truth, Bible literature. Though much literature was simply copied by hand, some was reproduced using elementary printing methods. When they were copying literature by hand, witnesses were grateful if they were put into isolation as punishment for preaching. Why? "It was good when I was put in isolation," says one sister. "I was better able to translate the watchtower there, as I was not disturbed so often." This is one of many ways in which persecutors' tactics were unsuccessful and often resulted in the advancement of kingdom interests. The importance of meetings. Opportunities to get together with other witnesses at meetings were rare and highly valued. Corinna Enica describes how she and another sister plucked up the courage to leave their work for a couple of days without permission in order to attend a meeting. "We left our work area in the evening," Corinna explains, "and walked to a railway station 15 miles away. The train departed at 2 o'clock in the morning, and we rode for 6 hours before disembarking and walking 6 miles to the meeting place. We found the right house and were trying to decide who would say the password when a brother came out, recognized us as sisters, and said cheerfully, 'You are at the right place. Come in.' We studied the watchtower and sang kingdom songs. It was a very upbuilding and faith-strengthening experience for us." When they returned to work 3 days later, they were relieved to learn that the farm manager had not even noticed that they were missing. Attending clandestine meetings did much to fortify the faith and courage of Jehovah's faithful servants. In another instance, a group of brothers were having a meeting in a prison when the guards arrived suddenly to search for literature. One brother, who had some pages of literature in his hands, quickly grabbed a broom and started sweeping the area. The guards searched, found nothing, and departed. Meanwhile, the literature was wrapped securely around the broom handle in the firm grip of the brother who was diligently sweeping the floor. The following is from page 226 of the printed edition. An underground theocratic ministry school. Under the ban, the brothers could never be sure how long they would have literature or even the Bible. Therefore, in addition to having a variety of different hiding places for literature, they tried to memorize as many Bible verses as possible. Most informal get-togethers were used to discuss and memorize Bible verses. For those gatherings, some made little cards that served as memory aids. On one side of the card was a Bible chapter and verse citation, such as Matthew 24:14, or a question or a Bible name. On the other side, they wrote out the Bible text or the answer to the question. Brothers used whatever spiritual publications were on hand to conduct meetings. The Theocratic Ministry School, for example, consisted of weekly classes, homework assignments, oral tests, and even examinations. There were reviews every 3 months and a final exam in the spring. One of the weekly homework assignments, recalls one of the students, was to memorize 5 Bible texts, which we had to recite at the next class. I remember the final exam in 1988. There was one examination card that simply said, "Recite 100 scriptures from memory." Strange as it may seem, everyone hoped to draw that card. Those assignments helped us the most in our preaching work, since we could rarely use the Bible openly. In 1990, the Estonian congregations were delighted when at last they were able to hold the Theocratic Ministry School the way the rest of the Worldwide Brotherhood did. Returning to the account, the power of true Christian love. "For 5 years, I worked underground in the coal mines," recalls Adolf Kose. "We were north of the Arctic Circle, where there is no daylight in the wintertime. It was dark by the time we came above ground at the end of our shift, so we didn't see daylight for months. We also did not get adequate food rations. This affected my memory and my sense of time. Because of the hard work, scarcity of food, and sheer exhaustion, We had only enough strength for casual conversation for a few minutes at a time. However, when discussing kingdom truths, we never felt tired. We could go on for hours. Through all the hardships, Jehovah's people learned to show self-sacrificing love for one another. Anything we had, explains Brother Kosei, or anything any of us received was distributed evenly among the brothers. Every one of us was in need, so we learned to share whatever we had with one another. Even the guards got to know that the witnesses always helped one another. When Aino Atma was transferred from one camp to another, she didn't have a spoon or a bowl, the very basics for camp life. "Well, that's okay," responded the camp supervisor. "Your sisters will give you what you need." And so they did. Time and again, displays of Christian love like this brought honor to Jehovah's name. Even so, tests of loyalty never ceased. For example, although Sister Atma had been in the prison camp for some time, the guards constantly asked her, "Are you still refusing to cooperate with us?" Of course, the type of cooperation they wanted was confidential information about Jehovah's Witnesses. "You detain me in prison camps, and my father and mother died because of you," Sister Atma always replied. "How could I ever cooperate with you?" Even in their prison bonds, the exiled witnesses continued to show Christ-like love by sharing the good news of the kingdom whenever they could. But to whom would they preach? The Soviet policy of relocating elite non-communist citizens actually opened a door of utterance for them. Many brothers and sisters enjoyed productive conversations with those well-educated exiles, who otherwise might not have easily heard or responded to the kingdom message. "Later we were taken to different camps," explains Brother Kosei. "There was a great witness work going on in every cell. I was able to do more witnessing then than I had ever been able to do before or have been able to do since." Through all the years of exile, the attack on Jehovah's Witnesses was relentless. They were robbed of their property and freedom, and they were humiliated in every possible way. But morally and spiritually, they were never defeated by their persecutors. The following is from page 186 of the printed edition. A letter to Stalin. On June 1, 1949, the responsible brothers in Estonia courageously sent two letters to Moscow. One was sent to Joseph Stalin and another to Nikolai Zhvernik, the chairman of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet. In the letters, the brothers demanded that Jehovah's Witnesses who had been arrested be released immediately and that the persecution against the Witnesses be stopped. The letters also contained a strong warning, drawing a parallel to the ancient Pharaoh of Egypt who refused to allow the Israelites to serve Jehovah freely. The brothers boldly stated, "Jehovah God's organization should be permitted to preach unhindered the good news of Jehovah's kingdom to all the inhabitants of the Soviet Union. Otherwise, Jehovah will utterly destroy the Soviet Union and the Communist Party." "We realized that it was quite a daring message," recalls Adolf Kosei. "We didn't want to risk mailing the letters from Tallinn, since they could be traced to us. So we traveled to Leningrad, St. Petersburg, to mail them from there." It is not known whether Stalin personally read the letter or not, but it surely got attention. While being interrogated, brothers were shown a copy of the letter on which was written, "This organization must be eliminated." Soon more brothers were arrested and the persecution intensified. The letter sent to Zhvernik has been found in the National Archives with a government stamp on it. Returning to the account.